Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We're the show that takes complex source material, digs through it, and pulls out the core insights for you.
That's the plan.
Today, we're really diving into the mathematical foundations, stuff that underpins, well, a lot of advanced computing.
Yeah, we're not just talking abstract math here. This is about the bedrock concepts, derivatives, convexity, that make things like machine learning, optimization actually work.
It's the groundwork for what the sources call Chapter 7. Right?
Yeah.
Establishing the guarantees needed for those more complex systems.
Exactly. We want to distill the core mechanics, how derivatives work, the geometry of these convex functions, and even a bit of information theory.
And looking through the material, two things really jumped out at me as being, you know, emphasized everywhere.
Oh, yeah. What were they?
First, convex functions. They seem absolutely central to guaranteeing that optimization processes can actually find a solution.
Absolutely crucial. Convexity gives you those guarantees.
And second, the chain rule. It pops up constantly, both like geometrically for rates of change over time, and then combinatorially for training networks. Backpropagation.
Couldn't agree more. The chain rule is the engine behind so much of this. So maybe we should start right at the beginning. Single variable derivative.
Yeah, let's do it. So what a dollar. What is it really?
It's just the slope. Forget the fancy notation for a second. It's the slope of the line that just touches the graph of the function at that one specific point, the tangent line.
Right. And that slope tells you everything instantly. Positive slope.
Function's going up right there.
Negative slope.
Heading down. Simple as that.
It's basic, but you need that intuition.
And there's a really fundamental rule connected to this. One, the source highlights. Zero derivative implies constant.
Ah, right. If the slope is zero everywhere across some stretch.
Yeah, if there's a zero over a whole interval, the function has to be flat there. It can't be changing. It must be constant.
That seems obvious, but I guess it's a foundational piece of certainty you build on.
Exactly. It's often a starting point for proving bigger things. Okay, so that's the slope. Now, the rules for combining these things.
Right, the derivative rules.
Mm-hmm.
Sum, product, quotient. We all probably memorized those at some point.
We did. But the one that really powers modern computation, especially anything with layers or composition, is the chain rule.
Okay, let's unpack that. The source uses that diagram with F, G, X, U, Y. How does that help visualize it?
Think of it like stages. Input X goes into function F, producing an intermediate thing, U.
Okay.
Then U goes into function G, producing the final output, Y. The chain rule just says the overall rate of change, how fast U changes when you wiggle X, is the product of the rates at each stage.
Yeah. So the change from X to U multiplied by the change from U to Y.
Precisely. Fratty dx, the changes just multiply as they flow through the system. It connects the layers.
That multiplication seems key. And these rules, they highlight some weird properties of functions too, right? Like the exponential function, xGalder.
Yes, xBeps, the special one. Its derivative is itself.
Which is still kind of mind-bending. The rate it changes is equal to its current value.
It is. That's why it's so fundamental for modeling growth, decay, anything where the change is proportional to the amount you have. Continuous compound interest, population dynamics.
And that property ties into its Taylor series too, doesn't it? Something about all derivatives at zero being one.
Exactly, because all its derivatives are also x to the nxp is all in one, so every phi o x n xp is one. So every phi of n xps n is just one, it shapes the whole series perfectly.
Okay, so what about its inverse, the logarithm, log xp?
Right, if log x, then its derivative is tied by.
And you said this leads us towards structure? Towards optimization.
Well, look at the negative logarithm. Y at 6 now. Yeah. Let's check its curvature. Take the first derivative. You get $1 log I. Take the second derivative.
Derivative of 6, 1 would be, so it's just 2 R set. So 1 by 2
A. Exactly. And 1 by 2 A is always positive, right? Assuming X is positive, which it must be for the log.
Okay, yeah. Always positive.
A positive second derivative means the function is strictly convex. It curves upwards like a bowl.
So log is convex. Why is that specific shape important?
Because that convexity is incredibly useful. It's the mathematical shape underpinning cross-entropy loss.
Which is used everywhere in classification models.
Everywhere. When you minimize cross-entropy error, you're essentially working with a function landscape derived from the negative log. Its convexity makes finding the minimum error much, much easier. It's a mathematically friendly shape for optimization.
Got it. So that structure, that shape is the key. Which brings us squarely to convexity itself. This seems like the major concept.
It really is. Whether you're maximizing something good, like likelihood, which often involves concave functions, curving down, or minimizing something bad, like error using convex functions. Curving up the shape dictates whether your problem is solvable.
And the second derivative is the main test.
It's the local test, yeah. Jdalevel means convex, curves up or is flat. Jdalevel means concave, curved down or is flat.
But the source mentions four levels. Quadratic, strong, strict, and just plain convex. What? The complexity. Why not just curves up? You mentioned strong convexity earlier.
Right. The distinctions are critical, especially for guarantees. Think of it like this, from most specific to most general.
Okay.
One, quadratic, like x to $2 plus bx plus c with $10. The second derivative is constant and positive. Simplest convex case.
Mm-hmm.
Two, strongly convex. This is the gold standard. The second derivative isn't just positive. It's bounded below by some positive number. So foxx, gif x, mx. It has to curve up by at least a certain amount.
Okay, minimum curvature.
Three, strictly convex. The second derivative is always strictly positive, 5x dogs. It always curves up, no flat spots allowed. This means the bottom must be a single point if it exists.
So at most one minimum.
Right. And finally, four, convex.
5x.
Flaxed off or could be flat, think 5x by four. It's flat at $6, but still convex. Or even a line, technically 5x.
So strong convexity implies strict convexity, which implies convexity. But why is strong the prized one? That lower bound, $10. What does that buy us?
It buys us existence and uniqueness of a minimizer, plus better behavior for optimization algorithms. That minimum curvature dollar forces the function upwards strongly enough as you move away from the minimum.
How does that guarantee existence?
It essentially ensures the function grows fast enough that it must have a lowest point. It prevents the function from flattening out too much or approaching a minimum infinitely slowly. Combine that with the strict convexity part, which ensures at most one minimum, and strong convexity gives you the unique global minimizer.
Ah, okay, so you know it's there, and you know it's the only one. That's huge for optimization. You're guaranteed to find the answer.
Exactly. And geometrically, it's intuitive. A convex function's graph always stays above its tangent line.
Right, like a bowl holding water.
But a strongly convex function is even more constrained. Its graph is squeezed between two parabolas determined by that minimum curvature dollar and some maximum curvature dollars, the lower and upper tangent parabolas.
So its shape is really tightly controlled.
Very controlled. That's geometrically why it behaves so well.
Incredible. Okay, let's shift gears slightly. What happens when we go from one variable to many? Functions like 51 by 2 dots, xd dolg.
Now, instead of one slope, we have slopes in each direction. These are the partial derivatives, frac partial xk. How the function changes if you only wiggle the kf variable.
And we collect all of those into the gradient. Nebula fishi.
Exactly. The gradient is just a vector containing all those partial derivatives. Frac partial by 1, dots frac partial sd.
What's the big takeaway? What does the gradient vector mean geometrically?
This is crucial. The gradient Nabla FD at any point, $6, points in the direction of greatest increase of the function, $5.
So if F represents a mountain landscape, the gradient vector points straight uphill, the steepest path.
Precisely. It tells you which way to step to increase your altitude, the function value, the fastest.
Which means if you want to minimize the function, find the valley.
You just go the opposite way. You move in the direction of Nabla FB Ashi. That's the basis of gradient descent.
But wait, in these high dimensions, how do we even know a minimum exists? Maybe the function just goes down forever in some direction.
That's a critical question, and the answer often lies in whether the function is proper.
Proper? What does that mean?
A function is proper if its value goes to positive infinity as you move infinitely far away from the origin in any direction. So 5x2 plus infinity as 6x2 infinity.
A giant bowl shape that keeps going up forever at the edges.
Exactly. It ensures the function doesn't flatten out or decrease infinitely. If a function is proper, it means any level set, all the points where below some value Tegeliar must be contained within some finite boundary. It can't stretch out to infinity.
And why does that matter?
Because there's a key theorem. A continuous proper function always has at least one global minimizer. The minimum has to be somewhere inside one of those bounded level sets.
Ah, so properness guarantees existence. Do we use this in practice?
All the time. For instance, proving that the least squares problem minimizing one axis, or ikxb22 as a solution, has a solution often involves showing that this function is proper. It guarantees a residual minimizer exists.
It's the safety net ensuring there is something to find.
It's prerequisite, yeah.
Okay, fascinating.
Yeah.
Let's loop back to the chain rule now. You mentioned a combinatorial interpretation for networks.
Yes, this is the other face of the chain rule. backpropagation. It's how we efficiently calculate the gradient of some final output, like prediction error, with respect to all the weights and inputs deep inside a complex network.
It's still the chain rule, but applied systematically across a graph structure.
Exactly. It's an algorithm built on the chain rule. There are two main passes. First, forward propagation.
Yeah, it's just calculating the output, right? Feed the input $6, calculate the values at the next layer, then the next, until you get the final output, signal flows forward.
Correct. You compute all the node activations moving from input to output.
And then comes the learning part, backpropagation.
Right. Here, you compute the derivatives, but you go backwards. You start with the derivative of the final output with respect to itself, which is just one.
Pretty, it's one.
Then you use the chain rule repeatedly to find the derivative of that final output with respect to nodes in the previous layer, then the layer before that, all the way back to the inputs and weights.
So the error signal flows backward through the network.
Mm-hmm.
We know the math is multiplication via the chain rule, but how do you keep track of it in a big network? Is there a simple recipe?
There are three core computational rules illustrated by that network example in the source, GOX plus Y max Y Z.
Okay, lay them out.
One, derivatives are computed backward layer by layer. That's a back and back propagation.
Got it.
Two, as the signal moves backward along successive edges, say from node A back to node B, the derivatives are multiplied. That's the standard chain rule, fracta chainer, multiplication along a path. Three, this handles branching. If a node's output affects the final result through multiple downstream paths, when the signal comes back, the derivatives arriving from those different paths are added together.
Ah, so if now, in that example, affects the final J through both the addition node and the max node.
Exactly. When you calculate partial J partial day, you have to sum the contribution coming back from the addition part and the contribution coming back from the max part. You add the incoming gradient signals at nodes where paths merge going backward.
So multiply along paths, add at forks when going backward. That addition rule seems crucial for distributing the error correctly.
It is. It ensures each variable gets the right total blame or credit for its contribution to the final output, no matter how many ways it influenced it. That's the organizational magic of backprop.
That structure makes complex learning possible.
Absolutely.
We've covered guarantees for finding minimizers, convexity, and the mechanism for calculating gradients, backprop. What about the quality of what we're optimizing? This brings us to information theory, right?
Yeah, connecting optimization geometry to the idea of information content, we need to look at absolute entropy, HPR, and absolute information, IPR.
And they're related how?
They're just negatives of each other.
Right.
Entropy, HP, IPR measures uncertainty. Information, IPI, measures certainty or surprise.
So high entropy means lots of uncertainty.
Exactly. Maximum entropy happens at PHE12NON$2 for a binary outcome. Think of a fair coin flip. You have the least information about what will happen next. Maximum uncertainty.
That minimum entropy.
That occurs at P$2 or P2NR1. If you know the outcome is certain, always heads or always tails, entropy is zero. You have complete information, zero uncertainty.
Okay. That makes sense conceptually.
No.
But how does the source connect this idea of information to the geometry of convexity and optimization we were just talking about? That feels like a leap.
It connects through a beautiful mathematical concept called convex duality. Think of a convex function and its dual function as two sides of a coin, representing the same information in different ways. The source highlights a specific duality. The information function IP turns out to be the convex dual of another important function called the cumulant generating function, ZCY by obules 1 plus I.
What does being duals mean practically?
It means their structures are inversely related. Specifically, their first derivatives are inverse functions. If TP exceeds EY, then conversely Y exceeds IY. It creates a direct mathematical link between the probabilistic view, AP information, and the optimization view, Y related to model parameters or log odds. It's a deep structural connection.
Wow, okay. So the math itself bridges information and optimization geometry. Speaking of geometry, let's define convex sets.
Simple idea, geometrically. A set of points is convex if you pick any two points inside the set, and the straight line segment connecting them is also entirely inside the set. No dents or holes allowed, like a solid ball or a cube.
And a convex hull.
That's the smallest possible convex set you can draw that completely encloses a given bunch of data points. Imagine stretching a rubber band around the outermost points. The shape it makes is the convex hull.
Got it. And these hulls are key for classification. This leads to the separating hyperplane theorem.
Exactly. This is a cornerstone of theoretical machine learning, especially for classifiers like support vector machines. Imagine you have data points belonging to two different classes, say class 0 and class 1.
Like cats and dogs in images.
Right. You want to find a boundary, ideally a flat one, a hyperplane in higher dimensions that separates them. The theorem gives a condition for when this is possible.
Which is?
The two classes are perfectly separable by a hyperplane if and only if their convex hulls, K$ and K$, do not overlap in their interiors.
So if the shapes containing each class are distinct and don't interpenetrate.
Then you can always find a hyperplane, potentially even a maximum margin one that sits right in the middle of the gap, to perfectly separate them. If the hulls overlap, no single flat boundary can do the job perfectly.
That's a powerful geometric guarantee for classification.
It really is. It connects the geometry of the data distribution directly to the possibility of linear classification.
This has been quite a journey. We went from just the slope of a line
All
the way through how changes multiply in networks via the chain rule and backprop to the guarantees provided by convexity for finding unique solutions, and finally to the geometry of separating data using convex hulls and hyperplanes.
And the thread connecting it all, as the sources really emphasize, is how these mathematical concepts, strong convexity, the chain rule interpreted as backprop, aren't just theoretical. They provide the actual guarantees, like unique minimizers, and the practical mechanisms that make sophisticated computation and learning feasible.
Absolutely. That link between strong convexity ensuring a unique minimizer and also ensuring the function is proper, so the minimizer is guaranteed to exist within bounds. I mean, that's really powerful.
It is.
Which leads to a final thought for you, the listener, that maybe ponder. When we face these huge, messy, real-world optimization problems, maybe optimizing a supply chain or training a massive AI model, the raw problem might not be nicely convex.
Often it's not, no.
So how much of the real work, the cleverness, is actually in the modeling stage? How much effort goes into reformulating the problem, choosing the right loss functions, maybe adding constraints or regularizers specifically to make it strongly convex, or at least convex enough to be solvable?
That's a great point. How much of the solution engineering happens before you even start the optimization algorithm, just by forcing the problem into a mathematically friendly shape, like strong convexity?
Is the hardest part sometimes just ensuring that unique, stable solution is guaranteed to exist in the first place by manipulating the mathematical setup? Something to think about.
A fantastic question about where the real work lies.
Definitely food for thought. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.